even if it were, there have been many, many, many traditions throughout history that we recognize need to be phased out or eradicated. And you know, if there is a tradition that forces something that half the population doesn't wish to embrace, or at least wishes to have the choice whether it should or shouldn't embrace, then that tradition needs to go.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal Halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today's topic is again Iran and the protests. And with me to discuss what's happening is writer and columnist Roya Hakakian. She is presently in Washington, D.C. or close by, she writes for the New York Times and Wall Street Journal, and is a founding member of the Iran Humane Rights Documentation Center. Roya has been highlighted among the most important activists, academics, and journalists of her generation. And she is, of course, also writing books. So it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you today, Roya.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We'll have to start with the murder, because the murder of Mahsa Amini, I think, shocked many people. And I've been talking to others saying that they were shocked and they were looking in great attempt to what was happening after that murder. So how did you react, and how did you hear about the murder of Mahsa Amini this autumn?
I was in a television studio doing an interview about a book of mine that tangentially related to a Kurdish story. And it was such a tragic coincidence, because, you know, the occasion of the conversation was to mark the anniversary of the assassinations of three Kurdish leaders in Berlin, Germany in 1992. And the book that I had written dealt with the story of that assassination, and then the subsequent investigation, and then the trial that was put on in Berlin, and then the verdict that was issued in 1997. So as we were in the studio talking about the release of the Persian translation of that book, which dealt with that story on the anniversary of those assassinations, somebody in the television studio came and said, "Oh, by the way, the Kurdish girl, Jina Amini, who had been in custody of the Murali police, just died in hospital." And, you know, my first reaction was, you know, the Kurds don't get a break. That, you know, it's been the one community that was the first target of the Iranian regime from 1979 onwards. And so that was my first thought, especially because it was the anniversary of the assassinations. And then, you know, later on, I think my bigger idea, my bigger thought centered around the fact that, you know, why is it that this particular person managed to bring out all these people onto the streets? Why was this killing different from any other that came before?
Because there's been a loss of killings, we know that. But this, as you say, maybe it was just the drop that said, now this is enough.
Yes. You know, it is sort of the last drop or the last straw that broke the camel's back, and so to speak. But I also think that, you know, every movement, as a friend of mine said very eloquently, needs an exemplary leader. That, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky right now is an exemplary leader for Ukrainians. But movements also, especially movements for democracy and freedom, also need exemplary victims. And in some ways, Mahsa Jina Amini is an exemplary victim. First of all, you know, she was not an activist. And that's a very important component to this whole story. Because, you know, oftentimes when people are politically oriented or they are actively challenging the status quo, other people have in some ways less sympathy because they think, you know, they were asking for it, so to speak, or, you know, they brought it on. They were, you know, if you're challenging the system, you should expect the backlash. But she wasn't. You know, she was a very ordinary girl with very ordinary dreams. She wasn't even, you know, a person who lived in the capital. She was from, you know, a small Kurdish city. She had come for a few days. She was with her brother. In fact, she even had her hijab on. It was just not perfectly the hijab that the regime expected. And she wasn't there to provoke or challenge anyone. And so if that could happen to her, then no one in Iran was safe. And I think that's really how she became the person in whom all the women and all the men found a little bit of their own loved ones in her or themselves in her. And I think, you know, this is why she became such a, you know, such, she was the one to just spark this great fire in Iran since September.
Yeah, because actually she was, we can say that she was killed just because of a little detail, a little straw of hair coming out from her hijab. And, you know, as you're saying, that little detail might seem, it's not important at all, really. But, and then as you say, there's not, what is now the limit for things that you can't do? Right. Probably the limit is you can't really now tell what is it. Anything goes then.
Right, exactly. I think the point of the story ultimately is if it could happen to her, it could happen to anyone.
Yeah.
And I think the moment people recognized that was the moment that everything blew up, that, you know, it was a very inflammatory act, which did what other murders or other arrests hadn't done up until that point.
So we could go back to or start with the interview that you gave to American Purpose in December 2022, and you called it the Iran you don't know. And to our listeners, you have to explain what don't we know and what did you tell the interviewers in that interview in last December? It's about a month ago, 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm. I don't exactly remember what I said then, but I can tell you what I generally believe that Westerners don't recognize about Iran.
Yeah, that's what you were telling them about, yes.
Yes. So, you know, I can go back a little bit to the time that I was a first new immigrant in the United States. And people used to see me, especially a few years after I had settled here, and they would say to me, when I told them that I was from Iran, people would say, "Oh no, you're not from Iran." And I would say, "Why not? You know, I'm telling you that I am." And they would say, "You know, you must be an exception. You can't be the rule because, you know, Iranians are devout Shiites. First of all, I'm not a Muslim." And then they would say, "You know, you don't have a hijab on, and that's not what an Iranian looks like. So you must be a marginal person." And it was a very, you know, in some ways, it really shook me up because, you know, in some ways, people were telling me that I was a fraud, that I wasn't who I was saying that I was. But in addition, I was feeling that the nation was being misunderstood, that so much else that was going on in Iran was being unheard. And so I think part of what has perhaps surprised the international community is the discrepancy between what the West thought of Iran and what Iranians articulated as being their aspiration. You know, simple things that, you know, even if you go to Wikipedia or you look up, you know, the data on the breakdown of Iran's population by religion, you will consistently see 99% Shiite. Mm-hmm. And so you will assume that these numbers really capture the true essence of the people. Well, they don't. I don't know. I'm not sure we can think about, you know, who came up with them, why they landed on these, you know, respectable websites, but they are downright wrong. And Iran has, just like so many of our own Western societies, been in a state of face-off, among secular forces in Iran and conservative religious forces for many decades, and especially since 1979. So there has been this ongoing struggle for at least 40 years between, you know, secular Iranians who did not ever want to have a theocracy replace the monarchy that they worked so hard to overthrow. And so what the West has consistently misunderstood is, first, to think that hijab is a tradition. Secondly, that because it was a tradition, it needed to be respected. And thirdly, that Iranians are, by and large, people who believe in their ruling clergy and Islam, and they are devout Muslims, and therefore they agree with the way that this regime has been operating. And all those three assumptions are entirely wrong. The hijab is not tradition. And by the way, even if it were, there have been many, many, many traditions throughout history that we recognize need to be phased out or eradicated. And you know, if there's a tradition that forces something that half the population doesn't wish to embrace, or at least wishes to have the choice whether it should or shouldn't embrace, then that tradition needs to go. Mm. And so this is the conversation that I hope that the Iranian movement is going to spark in the West, because we need to recognize that the first victims of Islamist extremism, Iranian theocracy, are the people of Iran and Muslims themselves. Mm. And we are not protecting them if we don't allow space to have these conversations about them.
Yeah. Can you also now describe the protesters? Because there's still large protests in Iran. And you said that half of the population might not agree with the wearing of hijab. But I might just ask you back, wouldn't you now think that it's more than half? Because if you say that all women, or at least many percentage of the women, don't want to do or want to be forced to wear hijab, and what about all the men that might support them? That makes up more than 50% of the population. And even, I don't know what kind of number we're talking about, but who is protesting now and how are they protesting? And can you say a bit about if there's something more to these protests this time than it has been before? Because we have seen protests in Iran before, but people are telling me this is something different. So can you explain?
Yes, I have been profoundly surprised by this round of protests in Iran, in a way that I wasn't surprised, say, in 2009, which was, you know, the last bout of most serious protests in Iran. That last very important sort of watershed moment of protests, which we all came to know as sort of the Green Movement in Iran, took place as a result of the election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to the office of presidency. And millions of people took to the streets to say, "Where is my vote?" Because people believed at the time that the election had been rigged. The difference between those protests and the protests we have seen since September is that there is no longer a conversation between the nation and the regime. In 2009, people were asking, "Where is my vote?" because they were still engaged with the regime, hoping that whatever amount of legitimacy they had, they would still exercise that in order to respond to what they were demanding. This time around, there has been no conversation. There has not been any sort of movement or slogans demanding for higher wages, although we've seen a lot of demonstrations for higher wages in the past. There have not been slogans that people have chanted or heard about water shortage or high electricity rates, although we've had those protests before. Everything that people had articulated up until September in order to demand something from the regime is missing from this round of protests. They are no longer talking to the regime. They're no longer expecting the regime to deliver anything to them. And I think that's one of the two fundamental differences. The marquee slogan is the dictator must go, which is profoundly important. You know, they are cursing the supreme leader. They're cursing the founder of the Islamic Republic, which was Ayatollah Khomeini back in 1979. These things were anathema. Iranians never went as far as addressing the supreme leader or the founder, but they have this time around. So the only other thing that I think is really worth noting is the fact that they are very focused on non-political aspects of social change. In other words, you know, these are not, you know, leftist Marxists out on the streets, and they are not, you know, conservative religious people who are affiliated with some kind of party that, you know, this Ayatollah or that Ayatollah runs. They are devoid of any sort of party affiliation or, organizational or political campaign. What they're asking for are the very basics of democratic values, which is, you know, the right to speech, the right to dress as they wish, the right to walk on the street hand in hand with whoever it is that they love or, you know, are wishing to walk on the street with. And I really think that in some ways differentiates this round of demands from anything else we have heard.
Is it then fair to say that this protest then is really, for one part, very fundamental, because they are asking for very fundamental things in a society? And the other thing is it frustrating for the government this time, because they're not asking about anything that they apparently can give them other than disappearing, of course, but it's not about giving them some food or giving them some more money or giving them, because they're not asking for anything, they're just asking them for going away.
Yes, exactly. Precisely what you said, you know, it must be much easier when, you know, your disenchanted people on the streets are asking for, you know, higher wages, because you recognize if it really threatens the foundation of your regime, you will find some way to make a compromise. But that's not what they're asking. But what also makes it interesting is that the regime also doesn't know what to do, because they say, so who is your leader? They don't have a leader, really. You know, it's not like somebody taught them to say, I want to sing or I want to dance. These are, you know, fundamental human desires. The very things that the youth who are turning on TikTok and going on Instagram see their counterparts do in other parts of the world. And it's very different from what the regime knows how to deal with, which is party organized, protests and demonstrations or organizationally controlled movements of people. This is something entirely different, and it's therefore not within sort of their toolbox of what to do when you see this.
Because we talked a little bit about who these people are, but we can go a little bit more into that, because for people not knowing Iran, you said Amini, she was from Kurdistan and she was a Kurd. And it's important, I think it's already happened, but as you said in the beginning, it's it was not now this time, oh, it's another carrot again, so those people again. It's could be as she was a woman and it's this was starting about to talking about the hijab. It could be a feminist protest. But then now what you are explaining is that this is a broader protest and more fundamental. And how can you say that people now are united? And can you tell it a little bit about where they are not only from the capital? We know that they're not only protesting in the big cities in Iran. They are probably all over, but they have no leader and leaders. So how is this actually happening from day to day? And who is participating? What are they doing? Mm-hmm.
Well, in the past 3-4 weeks, ever since the executions started, some of this has gone underground. We see more protests in sort of the outskirts of the country. In Balochistan, they continue to go on. In Kurdistan, they continue to go on. But in the major cities inside the country where the riot police and the regime's forces are more concentrated, we see them kind of go clandestine more, and there is less protests on the streets. And I'm not surprised. You know, I think you know the executions were unexpected; they occurred, and now a lot of the protesters need to regroup and figure out what to do next. So there is less of them occurring at the moment. But I think what's you mentioned. That it's become nationwide, whereas it could have been or should have been a feminist movement. Well, as you pointed out, they're not. They're far more inclusive than just women, even though a lot of people misidentify the movement as a women's movement. It's not. It's a national movement for freedom and democracy, which was sparked primarily by women, and which was fronted in at least the early days by women, but it's gone far beyond. And I think part of it is because men who were not standing by women during the 1979 revolution in Iran, men who didn't really recognize at the time when women took to the streets in Iran on March 8th of 1979 on International Women's Day to protest against the proposition to bring the hijab and make the hijab a mandatory dress code become law throughout the country. The men were not really convinced that they needed to stand by women and protest against this, that they thought that this is a women's issue, they didn't need to engage. But I think 44 years of the regime's dictatorship has proven to them, along with everyone else, that if one group becomes a second-class citizen, then everybody else's rights are also equally threatened. And I think that's why, after 44 years, you see men stand by women on the streets to support them in the same struggle. In the same way that, you know, in 1776, when the American founders came up with the Bill of Rights, and the Bill of Rights was only extending rights to white men. You know, white men weren't up in arms. But, you know, in 1960s, when Martin Luther King was spearheading the civil rights movement, you know, the majority of people in America, regardless of race, believe that in order for the American democracy to become more perfect, we needed to have racial equality. The same thing is happening in the context of gender in Iran today.
I think you have also been writing or that struggles for freedom in Iran and in Ukraine, which is also it's in another position, but it's also a freedom struggle. They are in a war, and we can talk about the connections with Iran there later, but you say that they have a good deal in common, and you also we haven't heard about that for a couple of months now, but it was also anti-regime protests mounting in China at some point. Can you tell us a bit about the commonalities and the distinctions between these three, or maybe two, Iran and Ukraine, maybe China, struggles for freedom?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I think there would have been no attack on Ukraine had Russia and Iran not successfully collaborated to support Bashar Assad in Syria for a span of many, many years. And I think after that successful collaboration, which really snuffed out entirely and obliterated the Syrian opposition to Bashar Assad, then Russia and Iran concluded that together they can raise other havoc in other parts of the world. And the international community, especially the United States and Europe, will be silent, because they were in the case of Syria. So once they, you know, honed their skills together, once they succeeded in one part of the world, they had no reason to believe that it wouldn't work elsewhere. And in light of America's and Europe's hasty departure from Afghanistan in the summer of 2020, it appeared to Vladimir Putin that that America would not want to engage with any other conflict beyond its own borders. And I think that left him feeling free that he could, you know, move on Ukraine, which he did. So what makes the, in some ways, in my belief, Iran to be an extension of, or the movement inside Iran be an extension of the movement in Ukraine to stand against Putin, is that these two nations share an enemy. And these two enemies have successfully worked together before, and they're successfully working together now. Iran obviously is sending drones. They're also sending members of the Revolutionary Guard Corps to train Russians to use the drones and operate them. Russians have sent their own riot police to train Iranian riot police to deal with the protesters. Some of the strategies they have used in dealing with the protesters are clearly lessons from, you know, Russian playbooks. They, you know, people have posted videos of, their attackers using drugs ahead of time before attacking them, which clearly means that they need to kind of put themselves in a stupor before they, you know, commit the crimes that they commit. So they are an extension of each other, because obviously if the Ukrainians win, Russia will be weakened and Iran will be weakened by extension. And I think it is very important for the international community to recognize that if the two enemies work together to prop each other up, we need to band together to also prop up the two nations that are rising against these two evil forces.
Mm-hmm. So we could dig a little bit more into the relationship between Russia and Iran here, because I know that you are hosting another conversation about this in a week's time. And but what you're actually saying is that Putin and the theocracy in Iran, those two units are working together. But on the contrary, the people of Iran are not participating in this connection. So they are actually protesting against their own government, so to say. So when we're talking about enemies, it's actually not, as if I've understood it, Iran is not an enemy apart from the top level. So that's why we should support the protesters, because they are actually working to get rid of those of their you know, present government theocracy and those people. And when they go, they won't be willing to cooperate with Russia anymore. Or have I understood this?
No, that's absolutely correct. And you know, it's interesting in Europe and in the United States, when Ukrainians are demonstrating in support of their own government and against Russia, and Iranian diaspora are demonstrating in Europe or in the United States, oftentimes they do joint demonstrations, which is very interesting because you see Ukrainian flag and Iranian flags flying together. So I think the two nations recognize that they are in this together. And I think the sooner the international community recognizes that too, the more successful will be the approach to what it is we need to do in order to strengthen the hands of both the Ukrainians and Iranians.
So Iran, of course, and both those two countries, they are sanctioned by the West in different measures, and Iran has been that for a long time. How does this work, and how do you see it can either help Iranian people or, on the contrary, that it can hurt them? And how is it possible to sanction something to get rid of the theocracy in Iran and not to hurt the population?
Right.
It's a difficult question, though.
Yeah, it is a difficult question. And I don't think, I certainly don't have a good answer, but the best answer is the one that people inside Iran have given. People have made it very clear that they are willing to undergo shortages and cope with whatever negative consequences that may incur if that leads to a better future. Because at the moment, you know, the youth in Iran, the young generation, can't envision a future for itself, which is why, for the first time in history, there are more Iranians out of the country, leaving the country than ever before. So, you know, this is the largest diaspora of Iranians throughout the history, and Iran has 2,500 years of history. So when we say this is the largest diaspora, it's a huge statement about, you know, a very long span of time. So people are leaving. In fact, the regime's own elite have secondary homes where their children and their wives and their families live, in Canada, in Europe, in the United States. So it isn't just that ordinary people can't envision a future for themselves. It's even the regime's own allies can't envision a good, comfortable life for themselves. And therefore, they ship their children and families to the West. And then they stay there so that they can reap the benefits of being in government in Iran. So, so this is to say that, yes, sanctions are hard and sanctions create pain. And I don't know economically, you know, I hope we can come up with smart sanctions that really put the pressure on those who are in power, not those who are not. But all in all, I think there come points in histories of nations where they recognize that they must suffer in order for them to reach a better future. We see that in Ukraine. You know, Ukrainians aren't willing to negotiate peace with Russia because they want to be rid of Vladimir Putin's influence in their country forever, and therefore they carry on. And I think Iranians very much feel that if suffering at this moment means that they can, in fact, reach the dream of overthrowing this regime and building a secular government that separates the affairs of religion from the affairs of governance, then that's a huge victory and worth them tolerating whatever harsh circumstances that might result from sanctions.
Mm. What do you think it will take then for them to succeed this time in the ultimate goal that is removing the theocracy in Iran?
I think
how long will it go on?
Well, I think the main problem is that, you know, the Ukrainians convinced the world, unlike what the world thought at first. You know, in February, everybody was giving Ukrainians 5 days, 5 days until Kiev fell. And that's why, you know, the American president had called Volodymyr Zelensky to say, would you like us to send a plane? You know, and so everybody had anticipated, basically written them off, you know, assuming that all of Ukraine will fall to Russia. Well, it took many weeks, or at least several weeks, for the international community to recognize that Ukrainians are not going to fall and they are not going to play dead just because the Western societies have decided that they don't have it in them. And once we saw how willing they were and how resilient they were and how serious they were about doing this, then the international community came together to, in a form of really unprecedented post-World War II act of solidarity to weaken Vladimir Putin, Russia's economy in every way possible. That has not happened with Iran yet. Mm-hmm. We don't have an international community that has come together believing that they need to exert the same pressure on Iran. If that happens, then the entire future of this thing changes. And you can see that this has not happened because, you know, 2 weeks ago, the EU took a vote whether or not list the Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran as designated as a terrorist organization. They finally voted against it. Now, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps have carried out countless operations on the soil of Europe and the United States, and they have escalated their activities in the past 10 years over and over again. And for Europe to now say we can't designate them because, you know, I think one of the European Union members had said because a court hasn't declared them as a terrorist organization is absurd. First of all, you know, the book that I wrote about the case of the Kurdish assassinations in 1992 ends in this moment where the verdict from the High Court of Berlin implicates the highest echelons of the Iranian regime, from the supreme leader to the Revolutionary Guard Corps, as having masterminded the assassination. So you can't say that, you know, it's the first time that Europe is hearing about the Revolutionary Guard Corps or that the European courts even haven't implicated the Revolutionary Guard Corps in the past. They have. But they didn't. They resisted designating the Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. And that's a sign that tells us that Europe does not want to really speak with one voice to Iran. If that major step finally happens, then I think the future of this movement changes in a drastic way.
Mm. So there are, of course, maybe a couple of other things that might be done as well in order to help them. And do you think that, or do you know of any contact between Ukrainians and Iranians in order to, I mean, to back up Iranians for doing the same or for holding out with the protests as they see that the Ukrainians are doing? I mean, you know, it could be communication, social media, I don't know, other things that might bring them together, or is this non-existent?
It's non-existent, but it's understandable why. Because it's two struggling people who are basically, I mean, in the case of Ukraine, it's life and death on a daily basis. You know, it's missiles that are landing on their residential buildings on a daily basis. So, you know, when you're under those circumstances, you can't also be expected to, you know, go organize with people from another nation who are, you know, as weak as you are, if not weaker. So they have to look to the West. They have to keep, you know, if they have any extra bandwidth to invest in any sort of building solidarity, it should be with the West to focus them on, you know, the help that they need to receive. So there isn't. But unfortunately, the opposite exists very robustly, that the two regimes recognize that they will sink or swim together. Mm-hmm. And if they help each other, they can assure each other's survival and vice versa. And I think that's why, you know, Vladimir Putin was in Tehran a couple of weeks ago. You know, they recognize what the rest of us have yet to recognize.
Mm-hmm. What can other, like yourself, exiled Iranians do? And what can Europeans or even Americans do, apart from what you just told me about about saying that the Guard would be a terrorist organization, which is one thing that the Europeans have voted against at the moment. Are there other things that both of these groups can do? The West, exile Iranians, and Americans, or do they tend to do something together?
Yeah. I think you know, people like, and I understand, and I wish I had, you know, like to have very pragmatic steps to take, like call your senator or, you know, go protest. You can do all those things. But the first most important step that the West, and I mean the United States and Europe, need to take is to recognize that if there was any way for the Iranian regime to change its behavior, it would have happened already. It's not a new regime. It's the same cast of characters since 1979. And Europe especially has done, and America, have done everything possible to try to arrive at a peaceful resolution with Iran. It didn't happen. I can name a dozen approaches that Europeans began even in 1999 with, after Ayatollah Khomeini died in Iran, when they felt that, you know, after 10 years, after 1979, Iran is ready for lightening up, for changing, for reforming a little bit. So whatever we thought we could try to arrive at a solution with Iran that didn't involve the regime's total change, as an international community, we have tried. We also tried as an international community to support the reformists in Iran a great deal. You know, we did it in the United States through exchanges of librarians and sports organizations, and, you know, sending soccer players and, you know, doing all sorts of second track diplomacy, and Europe certainly did, and we really tried to, as a Western society, we tried to uplift the profile of people like Khatami, like Rouhani, like a lot of other smaller intellectual reformists that came up in the ranks in Iran. It didn't change. At least the lesson we learned is that even if the reformists were serious about reform, the system is so recalcitrant that it cannot allow for change, that the system itself cannot give way to any sort of metamorphosis or change. So it's been 44 years. The best thing we can do is to recognize that whatever could have been tried has been tried. And now that the people have taken to the streets and they are jeopardizing and sacrificing so much to get rid of the regime, we should do the one thing we never wanted to do, which is support the fall of this regime. Mm. And if we can change our perspective as an international community to give support to the people of Iran at this moment, then that would be a huge step. So in other words, what I'm saying is that the contribution that the West can do is to shift its perspective. The time to say, oh, why don't we try engaging them, you know, with, you know, opening their markets, or some people say something as silly as, what if we lift the economic sanctions so they have money? And then if they have money, maybe, you know, some of it will trickle down and they will, you know, we will change the economy and it will, you know, change the system. We tried all that. And none of it worked. In fact, the regime is so corrupt that that, you know, their own people who are their own constituents and supporters can't benefit from the rich richness of, you know, oil products and oil revenues of Iran. So we need to change perspectives, both in Europe and the United States. And we also need to recognize that the case of Iran is going to impact every other country in the region. It will change the future of Iraq. And that's actually the conversation I'm going to be having at American Purpose with a former Iraqi ambassador, because he was the one to tell me, I hope your movement succeeds, because if it does, Iraq will stabilize and Iraq can have a future. Iraq hasn't been able to achieve that because Iran won't allow it. You know, the Arab-Israeli situation can drastically change once the support of Iran has been withdrawn from you know, the terrorist groups in that region. The future of Yemen will change. The future of Syria will change. So the case of Iran is a pivotal case that can affect the entire region.
Mm. Yeah, this is really important. So we can go back to end the conversation to see, to talk a little bit about those people. So if we say that it's possible to overthrow the regime in some ways, does Iran have a strong enough civil society and, at least the opportunities to establish political institutions, whatever they might look like? What I'm actually asking is, how do you see it's possible for them or for the people to transform and to do this? Because we know that one thing is the void that happens when something does just disappears. And if it does disappears, it might be violently. It might be like very sudden. It might be, we don't know. But then again, what's coming up? What is there to build on?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I can't say that I know the answer, because it would require that we have a crystal ball to look into the future. But one thing is for certain, Iran has a vast elite that has fled the country during the major brain drain of the last 20, 30 years, and have been successfully living in the West and other parts of the world. You know, so many of the CEOs in Silicon Valley are Iranians. And, you know, in whenever in the United States they try to figure out, you know, what immigrant groups are most successful and why, Iranians are among, you know, a handful of most successful immigrant groups that whose names pop up all the time. So there is no shortage of talent. There is no shortage of dedication, because, you know, the last time, which came, I think, in October, there was a call for demonstrations. 75,000 plus Iranians converged on Berlin to demonstrate in solidarity with the movement inside Iran. So there is a sense of solidarity. There are tens of thousands of people outside of Iran who are really rooting for change. And we know from the example of hugely successful Iranians, both in Europe and in the United States, that the talent is there. I also know that there have been groups who've been working on, you know, developing a new constitution, drafting a new constitution. There have been groups who are working on creating sort of a mission statement or a vision for change. So I'm really not so much worried about that at the time as I am about whether or not the West gets the idea that the time has come for us to band together in the same way that we banded with Ukraine against Russia, to do the same with Iran, to rid ourselves of one of the most important evil forces that's making not just Iran unstable, but the rest of the region unstable too. And if we take that leap, we can all be hopeful that the world will be a little more safer. And also we can be more certain that we have given the cause of democracy a leg up. Because if democracy keeps failing in different parts of the world, then there is little hope for others to rise up and carry out the same movement elsewhere. And we need to make sure that the forces of democracy in other parts of the world win in order for our own democracies to stay intact.
Oh, I think we should end on that note, Raya, because it's a little bit hopeful. And I would just hope, and I think you will agree, that we need to have at least two thoughts in our heads at the same time, because we need to think about Ukraine and we need to think about Iran. We can't just think about Ukraine, which has been what most people have been doing the last year. And we are in February, so now it's been a year since the invasion soon. But thank you very, very much for joining me. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today, Raya.
Thank you, Matilda. I enjoyed it too.
So if you like Liberal Haltime, you can rate us and recommend us and give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. And information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Haltime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Moderne medier.